You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us.
Well, I am here with you, with Monica. We are back from our one-week hiatus where we were refreshed, where we reset, where we got a chance to hang out together and to read the Bible and pray and just enjoy each other's company and kind of have a little bit of a breather. So that was a great time. We didn't go very far. We didn't do anything special as far as location. We just went up north to Bonner's Ferry and hung out up there, beautiful terrain and landscape, but had a great time. One thing I wanted to mention about it real quick is reading large portions of Scripture. Now, what I mean by that is say, taking something like the book of Genesis and reading it all in one day. Okay, so we did that, and I found it very beneficial. It's certainly not something I'm used to doing. Usually we have, you know, reading programs where you read a little bit of the Old Testament, a little bit of the New Testament, or whatever, and maybe it's just, you know, one chapter of each a day, etc. It's kind of hard to get the kind of the big picture. And so we decided to do that. We decided, hey, you know, on this retreat, we would spend quite a bit of time reading. And so we did that, and I found it very beneficial.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, and we didn't just read Genesis. We read through quite a few books of the Bible.
Yes, and that was just one example.
Yeah.
One day we decided, hey, today we're going to read the entire book of Genesis.
Yes. So, I thought it was really good, too. And we don't get an opportunity to spend that much time on a daily basis, generally, reading Scripture. And I think there's something special about hearing it out loud, too, and not just reading it silently.
Right, yeah. So, it was read aloud, and we got a chance to really see, for example, in Genesis, you see God's redemptive plan throughout, through all the patriarchs and everything that happened there. And of course, that ties in everything else in our daily reading.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to transition to today's worldview segment, which we're actually going to just talk about what it means to have a worldview, or what is a worldview. Mm. And a good working definition of worldview is all those beliefs that you have, whether they're thought about or not thought about, known or unknown, your fundamental presuppositions that develop how you interpret the world or how you think about the world. So when you're presented with information, you subconsciously view that information, interpret that information. That's all based on a worldview, and it's important for us to understand that everyone has a worldview.
Absolutely.
So not only is it how we view the world, it's something that we must purposefully cultivate.
Yes, and be aware of it. Like sometimes even just sitting down and reading things or realizing, wait a minute, the thoughts that I have on this are not in agreement with Scripture. Understanding what you believe really helps you to be able to change and shift your thinking to a more biblical viewpoint rather than one that you've been taught in the world.
Yes, right. So if we take that and provide an example. So everybody has a worldview, okay? And I want to compare the worldviews, and there's lots of them. And of course, it's all mixed. You can't just like put somebody in a box and go, oh, they believe this is their worldview, okay? Because that's not accurate either, because you can even have, say, a Christian who says, I have a Christian worldview. It's like, well, okay. We have to break that down, because in reality, I think most of us have a mixture of worldviews that we're not even aware of.
Yes, and especially if we've been raised in the public school system, or if we've gone even to university, where a lot of things have been fed to us that we haven't stopped to evaluate before they've even entered our thinking.
Yes, and hence, because of that inculcation, we have to understand what worldview is. It's something that we need to concentrate on, because it's just not done.
Yeah.
So, for example, if we look at atheism, which of course denies any type of supernatural Of course, denies a God of the universe, specifically a God of the Bible or any God. So an atheistic worldview, and again, we're not putting them into any kind of a particular box, but they would just view the natural world as all there is. And so an atheist who is consistent would have to say, really, there's no meaning or purpose in the world. Everything is materialistic. In other words, there is only material. There is only a sense that we're just a natural being and that's it. There's nothing. There's nothing. You know, we're the result of natural processes over long periods of time that have evolved. And there is no meaning, purpose, or essentially value in human beings other than the life that they're living at that moment.
Right.
Okay, so I'm not saying that an atheist doesn't have even values or morals, although they borrow that from a Christian worldview. Okay, without realizing it. As opposed to that, you have a Christian worldview. Okay, so Christian theism, that's going to use this as kind of a working definition. So this is the contrast. So the Christian theist worldview would define theism as of a view of God who is transcendent, in other words, above all things, and immanent, personal, and infinite, who creates, sustains, and controls the world. So not just above all things, but also involved in today's world. Okay, so not just kick-started it and then, you know, was kicking
hands
back
off.
And hands off. That would be more of a deist worldview. But involved in the world, sustains the world, controls the world, etc. Okay, so that's just real, real basic on worldview. Again, a worldview is how we interpret the world, how we think about it. And of course, that's all based on our fundamental beliefs, our fundamental presuppositions, or our fundamental assumptions about the world. Okay, so if you assume that the God of the Bible created, sustained, and controls all things, you're going to look at information in the world much differently than someone who says there is no God. We're all just based on random processes over long periods of time.
Yeah, and even if we're not aware of our worldview, our presuppositions before going into anything, those are some of the hardest things to change. So when you're sitting talking with somebody who has these beliefs, those are going to be the hardest thing to try to even get them to evaluate or to consider true or untrue.
Yes.
That is the hardest thing to change. And you have to understand that about yourself.
Right. So a perfect example is if you have somebody with a distinctly Christian worldview and somebody with a distinctly atheistic view, and they can both look at the same piece of evidence, the same piece of so-called scientific evidence via the scientific method, and come to two completely different conclusions.
Yeah.
Okay. And both would be, I want to be careful here, both would be logically valid. Okay, not necessarily one of them is going to be true and one of them is not going to be true, but it's logically valid, as in based on my assumptions, I can come to this conclusion because of X, Y, and Z.
Right, and that's why you can have creation scientists and you can have evolutionary scientists, and both can, like you said, logically argue their position, but they're again coming from the presupposition of there is no God, or there is a God and he's active in the world today.
Right, exactly. Okay, we're going to transition now. And one of the things that Monica and I have been passionate about for a long time is obviously worldview issues when it comes to Christianity, but also entrepreneurship, developing skills, homesteading, you know, many different aspects that if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you probably know this already. But one of the things that we've been exploring lately is what's called non-timber forest products, okay, or also called special forest products. And there's lots of different names for these types of products, but this is something that we've really been looking into, and we've even recently gone to some classes, you know, some individual lectures that are based on just extension, just half-day lectures on where experts come in and they talk about forest products, forest gardening. You know, so for example, that would be, say, wild mushrooms or berries or medicinals that you pull out of the forest, etc. Now, we view this a little bit differently. Of course, we look at it from the perspective of personal use for our family, but also we can't help but be entrepreneurial And we're constantly looking for small business ideas, not only for ourselves, but for other people as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things we're passionate about, and helping people to find a different way, create their own businesses, supplement their income of their family, you know, whatever. So we can do these things through building a family economy through something like developing mushrooms. You know, mm-hmm. that would be one example. So we went to this training and got some good information.
Yeah,
I would say. And so, what did you think about it as far as overall the approach to looking at a forest differently?
Well, I honestly never thought about some of the items that he talked about being wanted or you know, marketable in society. So like cuts of branches off of pine trees. I mean, right. to us, that's okay. That goes in the burn pile. We're going to burn that up. Well, get close to the holidays and suddenly those are useful, you know, needed. Right. We know the use of, you know, pine needles for medicinal teas and things like that. So that wasn't any surprise, but cultivating mushrooms and having a good market for that, especially if you dry them,
yes.
That increases the price so much. So there was a lot of really interesting things that he was talking about that I would never have thought to market or to produce.
Right. I remember one example that related to this that we noticed, because of course we're always watching these types of things, is that we were in this last fall or close to winter time, close to Christmas time, we were in Costco. And we noticed that they were selling Western red cedar boughs. And, you know, it was like a clump of four or five boughs, maybe 2 to 3 feet long. And I think they were, I don't know, about $8 maybe?
Yeah, they were. They were around $10, I think. And the other thing that we saw was pine cones.
Yeah. So, I mean, but the point is that these grow all over our property.
Yeah.
These grow all over state and national forests.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did some pruning, and it's like, wow, we pruned off like hundreds of dollars worth of boughs.
That's true.
But there's also the idea that, you know, you could get a permit and go on to national or state forest land,
mm-hmm.
and you could prune some of this stuff and sell it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just one example.
Because I think that when I looked at the trees, I looked at them as wood. Okay, so they're marketable for firewood, possibly, you know, to use.
Medicinals.
Yeah, I looked at that, but I guess I was thinking more of trees. I looked at trees as only useful for wood.
Right. So, you know, 2x4s and,
yeah.
and you know, lumber.
Stumps to sit on or, you know, something to make as a you know, a rough-hewn bench or
sure.
something like that. But I never, ever thought... Well, of course. I mean, I see greenery like that even in...
Floral arrangements.
Yeah. When you go to your florist, and especially around Christmas time, you see all these, you know, pine type or conifer style branches in there. Well, where do they get them from?
Yeah. Another example is, it's funny because we look at something like Scotch broom as an invasive weed that we need to destroy. We need to destroy it. We need to cut it off before it flowers. We need to spray it, kill it. And they said one of the most, of course, Mother's Day being the time of year where most flower arrangements are sold, that likely every single Mother's Day arrangement that you find is going to have some Scotch broom in it as far as the greens is.
Right.
So that was interesting to me. It's like, yeah, so... The problem is the solution, which is a permaculture principle. And you look at it, it's like, well, Scotch broom is a problem. Okay. And let's work on reducing it in our pastures and getting rid of it or at least controlling it. But maybe there's a market there.
Yeah.
So what about, you know, one of the things that we have discussed many times is value added. You know, taking a raw product and then... Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, because he talked about the difference, and we could really appreciate this, the difference between a commodity and a product. So a commodity being that there's somebody out there that is trying to actually put together maybe a wreath kit, And so they're purchasing separate items from different suppliers. Mm-hmm. So we would go, oh, well, here, let's cut all these greenery and we'll sell just the greenery to these people who are putting together the kit.
In bulk.
Now, we're not going to make that much money off of selling the greenery. But as soon as they put it together in this wreath-making kit, they've been able to increase their profit and increase the cost of this because now it's a product. Now, if they take it one step further and instead of making the kit, they actually make the wreath, now they've probably doubled what they can sell that product for. Now, we've made very little money from selling the greenery. The person who's made the kit has made a little bit more money, and the person who's made the wreath has made a lot more money. So we can decide, you know, do we want to make it have a commodity or do we want to make a product?
Right. And the answer for the small business owner is you want to make a product. Okay, because, again, it's the difference, for example, in saying you're going to pick strawberries by the carton versus going to a farmer's market and selling a few ounces of strawberries. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, or making a strawberry jam.
Or making a strawberry jam, value added. Yes. So each step is you go from picking the boughs, and then adding that value and making it into a kit or making the finished product, you're adding value at each step, just like you said.
Now, I want to use an example because the other day when we were in Bonner's Ferry, we went to a store, and one of the things that I saw was this fun little soap kit that you can put felt around the soap, and so you're using that as kind of your... You literally just take the thing and you're rubbing the soap on. So it preserves the soap a little bit longer. It stretches it. And it also serves as kind of it's not harsh abrasive, but a little bit of a scrubby for your skin to slough off some of the older skin and things like that. Well, she was selling it as a kit, which at the time I thought, well, isn't this interesting? I think if she had brought it one step further and actually made the product, she could have sold it for more. And not that I wanted to pay more because I didn't. I appreciated that the kit was there. But then I also thought about, wow, she brought out all her wool product and all the soap that she had bought. And I think making homemade soap would be better. But I looked at it and I thought, okay, so the person selling the soap didn't make that much money off of this. And the person selling the felt, or not felt, but wool, didn't make that much money off of it either. But now she's put it together and has probably tripled her investment just selling as a kit. She probably could have, I don't know, gotten six times as much if she sold it as just little bars of soap pre-made with this felt wrapped around it. Because everyone would go, oh, wow, that's really neat.
She's added value.
She's added value. And the people that were selling, I'm not saying that selling soap is, there's anything wrong with that. Because that may be your specialty and you just want to stick with that. But she bought that soap at a cheaper price and was selling it more expensively because she's putting it together with wool.
Right. And now, so you just think about that example a little bit, take it a little bit further. How could you further add value to it? And so we look at some of the marketing ideas that we have. And so, for example, you mentioned the homemade soap.
Yeah.
You know, homemade or local, locally made goat's milk soap or, you know, whatever. There's all kinds of marketing techniques that we can talk about. And it's not to pull one over on the customer.
Right. It's
but
not.
It adds value to the customer because lots of people care about these things.
Right. And like he said, one of the most popular words right now or the most popular word right now in marketing is natural.
And local. Right.
And local.
Right.
Natural is number one. And he said, what is natural? I mean, you know, you can really... misuse that word there's a lot of things that are natural that are not necessarily good for you.
Correct. Right. So we can look at our forest out the window here and go, hey, we have a natural, local, organic, sustainable, you know, forest. Yep. And, you know, it's homemade. No, I'm just kidding.
No. Well, and that's the thing with the soap. Like that's something that I do want to get into is making homemade soap from our goat's milk, and that would be something that would be very marketable.
Yeah.
Do you, when you do it, can you wrap it in wool and felt it? Yeah. Have I made it more marketable? Sure have. And then you package it in two and put a pretty little ribbon around it with a little, you know, tag.
Right. Yeah. And you know, and these aren't just false words to us. You know, we actually support these things local. Why? Well, we want our local economy to thrive. We want
it to be resilient, sustainable.
We want to give back to our community. We want to encourage small business and farming,
right,
local farming.
Right. If I can avoid buying bars of soap that was made in China and buy them locally, well, of course. I mean, why wouldn't we support that? That makes sense.
Yeah.
Right. And again, it's all about resilience and living a little bit, being a little bit more self-sufficient. And what I mean by that is that your community, your local community is helping each other to be self-sufficient.
Yep.
And you really can't do that if you're dependent on everything to be trucked in.
Yeah. Like, I'm really looking forward to the farmer's market opening up this coming summer.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good place to not only network and meet other artisans and farmers around the area, but to get really good quality products.
Right.
That they've either grown or made in their own homestead or farms and brought to the market for us.
And we can take their ideas and then add value. I want to ask you about one thing here real quick. As far as small business, as far as marketing, as far as non-timber forest products or any other homemade product or cottage industry food that we're trying to sell, how important is it to be personable? How important is it to – how important is the emotional intelligence in all of this?
Well, I would say it's paramount. You can have a wonderful product, but if you are not a people person – or you honestly don't like people and you don't want to deal with all of their complaints or questions or whatever, you probably shouldn't get into direct marketing. And I think that's something that he touched on really well, is that you may just want to be a supplier. Now, that means that you're going to make a whole lot less money.
Right. But maybe that's, you don't want to deal with people and it's like, you know what, I'm good with selling a commodity, or I'm good getting a reduced amount and I'll just sell you the bows, and then you can do all that other stuff and deal with people.
Right. Because that's one thing that we found when we ran our business, many years ago, not many, I guess it's several years ago, but is that dealing with the people was an art. And the first rule that we followed was the customer is always right. Do not argue with the customer. If they're unhappy with the product, you replace it or you give them a refund.
Right.
Word of mouth is one of the most important marketing tools you have.
Yes.
And if you make one person unhappy with your return policy or with your replacement policy, they are going to tell everybody and their mother how terrible you are.
Yeah.
The terrible customer service, and you never made it right, and they're unhappy. And that right there damages your reputation and will probably make a third of the people who would have become customers not even be interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, and that's true. And it's obviously, we're not talking about someone who's trying to cheat the company or trying to, totally take advantage. But it was, even if it was, we understood, we knew that the customer was being unreasonable, we still did it anyway.
We did. There were times where people, they misordered. They misordered.
So, yeah.
And they accidentally picked something and they did the wrong name. We made it exactly how the order form was.
Right.
And I was able to look at it and go, no, that she ordered this and that's exactly what we made. But she said, but that's not what I meant. And it was like, you know what? Okay. I don't want you to be unhappy with that.
Right.
So send that back to me and I'll remake it how you're asking for it.
Yep. Exactly.
And that was that. You know, it just didn't matter. It wasn't that big of a deal. It was more important to keep that customer and to keep that happy customer word of mouth. And as a matter of fact, the person I'm thinking about very specifically was one of our first customers within the first 6 months. And she not only was a consistent customer with us over the years, I mean, she bought a ton of bags, but she
brought in other customers.
She did. She told everybody.
Right. So it would have been silly in hindsight to say, nope, this is what you ordered and we're not going to lose out on this, you know, whatever amount of money, $50, and in turn, it brought us in probably thousands of dollars in revenue.
Yes, okay, because so she hosted a party, and you know, she. The one thing that I also learned is that if you are an entrepreneur and you've grown to the point where you have people representing your company, whether it's through home reps or you're selling at a farmer's market, and maybe you've hired somebody to stand in for you at the farmer's market so you can be marketing somewhere else, you need to make sure to pass that commitment on to your employee or representative, because many times if they don't understand the importance of customer service and saying, nope, customer's always right, they will. Just like we had, you know, a little incident.
Tell them about the example of the coffee shop in Bonner's Ferry.
Okay. Yeah. And I almost want to drop the name because I wasn't happy with them. So I'm all for customer service. And that's really, if somewhere has good customer service, I'll probably go back, even if their food or drink or whatever wasn't awesome.
Right.
Okay. So we went into this little local coffee shop that was a cute little place. And we went in and we ordered something basic.
Yeah. I just want brew coffee.
Brewed coffee. And I got an espresso. A double espresso. And I just wanted some cream. So did Sean. And so after we paid, which of course these were kind of cheap drinks, but after we paid, we said, can we, you know, get some cream? And she asked, do you want half and half or do you want
whipping cream?
Whipping cream. And we said, oh, we'll take whipping cream. Might as well do the whole cream. And
yeah.
She brought it out and she put just a tiny little dollop in this little silver, you know, milk pour thing, a little tiny pitcher. And I said, well, can we get just a little bit more? Because he's going to have some too. And as she's pouring it into this little tiny pitcher, she said, well, this is really expensive stuff. And I thought, okay, now I feel guilty. Right. Stop pouring. Yeah.
Stop pouring. And then she
way overpoured. She went from this little tiny dollop at the bottom to filling this whole thing up. Well, now I felt compelled since the price is so high to use it all. And I felt guilty.
Yeah.
But she gave me the option. And don't give me the option if you don't want the person to take that option.
Right.
Just give me half and half. I would have been perfectly content with that.
Or if you give the option, then...
Don't mention the price.
Even if you're thinking in your head, don't say it.
Yeah, you don't go, well, this is really expensive. Like, you better drink it all. And I tried. I couldn't. I put way too much milk in mine and put way too much milk in Sean's, cream. And then we walked out of there extremely unhappy. And
I'm like, well, okay,
never going back there. Yeah, we're never going back there again. I didn't care how good the coffee was.
Yeah.
I was not happy with the customer service. And she should never have mentioned price. Don't do that.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
I don't think that she was the owner, but I'm sure the owner would have been very unhappy with that comment.
Yes, exactly. you don't need to be bringing that up. And I think it was probably the daughter.
And again,
you need, even with your family members, you need to make sure they understand how important it is to just be friendly, satisfy the customer and make sure that they're happy when they leave your shop, your store, your storefront, whatever it may be. They're happy people when they leave.
Absolutely. Okay, let's transition back a little bit to non-timber forest products. Because this is great stuff as far as entrepreneurship and marketing, and we're kind of applying that to, in this case, non-timber forest products. So let's just kind of go through a list of what are some of the things that you could pull out of a forest. An important point to that is whether that's your own forest, or even if you don't have a forest, you have access to forests. I guarantee it. And it, like I said before, you know, you're responsible for looking into the local laws and of the state land, or if it's national forest, what you can pull out of there, what you can't, if a permit is required.
Yeah,
you know, all of that. Now, in our case, obviously, we have some land, so we have forests that we want to forest garden out of, which is another term that we could talk about, but I think you get it. But some groups, some products that could be either commodities or products. So you have wooden crafts, this is beyond the 2x4 that comes out of a forest. And it's some of those things you mentioned. It could be specialty logs as far as making into benches or wooden bowls or...
Yeah, baskets. I mean, you know, you're pulling willow or whatever and making baskets.
Right.
There's name plates that, you know, you have a hewn piece of wood and
you do
wood burning to make that.
Or, you know, you take some interesting branches that are fairly thick and you could drill recessed hole and put some tea lights in there, and all of a sudden you have a centerpiece.
Yeah, you have a good product. As a matter of fact, good friends of ours bought us one, and every time we look at it, we think, we can make that.
So easily.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's literally would cost almost nothing.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, in a little specialty shop, you know, that's going to be sold for $8 or $9 or $10. Or
oh, I think more than that. I actually do. I think it's probably closer to 30 or 40.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
Then we should be making those right now. We should get off this podcast and start making those. All right.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay. So here's some more. So native landscape plants. You know, people will spend money for native plants. It's interesting. I mean, honestly, it blows my mind. You can go on to some of the nurseries, and if I buy a young tree, a Western red cedar or a tamarack or a Doug fir, I'm amazed. It's like I can't cut them down fast enough around here to, you know, thin properly, and they're being sold online for $8 or $9, you know, a piece for a little sapling.
I know. We've got a ton of saplings. We should be doing that too.
and we have talked about that. And that's one of the things I've mentioned before is a great little small business either on the side as a supplement or a full-time business is a nursery.
Yeah.
And a perennial nursery. Besides some of the native plants and wooden crafts, there is the category of edibles. This is a huge category not only is it a lifetime of study, but it is a huge, huge opportunity.
Yeah.
Even if you're going after only a few things, like say mushrooms and only safe varieties for, you're going to go after, you know, particular kinds of mushrooms, for example, lots of opportunity here, to harvest, going forward.
The other thing would be a lot of berries.
Oh yeah,
berries are. I mean, we were in just one of the chain grocery stores recently, and they had this little freezer that had 1 gallon bags of wild picked blueberries. Now, actually, I don't even think they're wild. They were cultivated at someone's homestead, but they were, you know, a wild
variety.
And for 1 gallon, how much was it?
Like
it was
$20.
So expensive. Yeah, it was like $20 for a 1 gallon bag of frozen blueberries.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, people love them. And that's how huckleberries are here. Huckleberries are so expensive.
Yeah. You know, that's a great example. Huckleberries here in Northwest Idaho, or Northern Idaho, I should say, in the Northwest, but particularly in Northern Idaho, huckleberries is a huge, huge industry. Anything you can think of has had value added via huckleberries. I don't care if it's huckleberry beer.
Huckleberry honey.
Honey.
Chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate. That's a good one. And about anything else that you can think of.
Yeah.
And people dig it up. I mean, they love it.
They do. And small little, like not even quart-sized Ziploc
jams
bags.
Jams and jellies, of course.
Are going for like $12 a bag for these just little tiny bags of huckleberry at these little... You know, someone pulls over with their van, opens up the back, and they're selling these little bags of huckleberries, and people buy them.
Right. And those are, you know, you can grow cultivars of huckleberries. But most people around here pick them wild because it happens to be a big industry. There's a lot of them, and they pick them wild.
Yeah, and just make sure to beat everybody. Because I bumped into a lady this last year who was taking her kids out huckleberry picking, or she had taken them out huckleberry picking, and went up to this one area that's really well known for huckleberries, and there was a ton of people out there, and she's like, people were so competitive, her kids were trying to pick something, and literally someone came over and sort of shoved them off the bush and started picking the bushes or the huckleberries that were there. So, you know, find your spot and don't tell anybody about it.
That's right. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about floral crafts and green holiday greenery.
Mm-hmm.
But how about the value added there with like making wreaths or what are those things called? Swags.
Like a door swag, yeah. And even the long things you put across your
ropery. I don't know what you call it.
I can't remember. Silly. But you know, across your fireplace mantle, you know, decorative things like that, where again, you're taking the basic commodities, whether it be berries that you picked, or like we have Oregon grape growing, and in the winter, the spiky leaves turn red. So it looks like holly. And it's got this vibrant color that you can add to the greenery that adds, you know, a pretty touch, especially for the holidays. And then taking free pine cones, which, you know, when I lived in Yuma, we didn't have pine cones there. There was no pine cones. And I was really trying to decorate for Christmas, and I wanted some pine cones. And I remember going to the craft store, buying a bag of pine cones for like $8 or something.
Right.
For, I don't know, 12 pine cones.
Right.
You know, of variety sizes or whatever. And that was one of the things he talked about at the class. And I thought, isn't that funny that it's probably just somebody walking around their property picking up two big pine cones, two small pine cones,
right,
two tiny pine cones, and, you know, some, I don't know, other special kind of pine cone. And then they're putting it in a bag, putting it in paper, you know, putting a paper label on it and selling it to people for ridiculous expensive. Yeah. I mean, I sent the kids out pine cone hunting this last year to decorate throughout the house and our tree. And they came back with like buckets.
Yeah, I mean, it's so very simple when you're in a pine forest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's some great ideas there. Christmas trees. And then beyond the Christmas tree farm, what's pretty popular now is the quote-unquote natural Christmas tree.
Yeah. Sure, come out through our forest. Pay for the experience.
Yes.
We'll serve hot chocolate and wassail.
Well,
and
I mean, that's a great thing to bring up because people do want that experience. And that's, yeah, you know, we kind of joke about it, but it's serious. I mean, people are so starved for experience, natural experience, a homestead experience, something that gets them away from their cubicle life.
Yeah.
Cubicle and plastic life. And they would gladly go pay $100 to go spend several hours. Maybe there's a meal involved. And they get a chance to go out and pick a wild, natural, organic Christmas tree.
With their children.
With their children. Yeah. They get to. One of the things he mentioned is like that I thought was really interesting. And they've done, you know, kind of marketing studies. The average person at a Safeway, for example, or a Costco or a Walmart or whatever that buys a Christmas tree spends about 8 minutes.
Yes.
Picking out a Christmas tree. Okay, this, again, nothing against anyone, but what they're doing is that they're looking for that traditional perfect Christmas tree, and they don't really care. It's just like, grab the Christmas tree, let's go.
Right.
There it is, you know, and I expect it all to be the uniform size, etc. As opposed to people that go out to these Christmas tree farms or natural, quote unquote, natural Christmas tree picking areas, they'll spend 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
The average family would spend 3.5 hours. And the difference is the experience.
The experience.
And they're paying more for it.
Right.
Because isn't perfect either.
Right. As a matter of fact, he mentioned that one family who were leaving with two Christmas trees, but both of them kind of sparse looking. And he's like, oh, you're taking two trees? He goes, no, we're going to wire these things together to make one whole tree because the limbs were so bad on one on each side.
Right.
But he figured that putting them together into one would create one, you know, nicer looking, a little bit fuller Christmas tree.
Yeah. And, you know, and if you know anything about forests, that's what you're going to get in, you know, natural trees.
Yeah.
When we do thinning here through our forest, we see that all the time.
Yeah.
You'll pull out a young tree that's it wasn't going to make it anyway because the canopy is practically closed around it. One side of it will be much thicker than the other side, depending on the stems per square foot. So that's what you're going to get.
And yeah.
But, you know, people are actually kind of wanting that.
Yeah.
They're tired of the plastic life.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. They're looking for something that, again, includes that experience and then something that brings that experience back into their home.
Right.
And they can relive it just by looking at it each day.
Yeah. In the United States of America, the non-timber forest products industry is $4.5 billion. That's pretty big.
Yeah.
And you know, the reality is that's probably a third or half the size of the actual market. Most people who are pulling stuff out of the forest, it's either for personal use, so it doesn't even count in this number.
Right.
But, I mean, there is value there. When you pull out mushrooms from a forest, use it for personal consumption, consider how much that costs in a grocery store.
Yeah.
So it's a huge industry. And then, of course, there's kind of an underground market, I'm sure, where people are maybe selling to their friends and neighbors, etc. Yeah. You know, who knows how big that is.
Making wreaths and people are buying
them. Yeah, and even, I guess, supporting. Even if they're for gifts or something else, it's still industry. It's still part of the industry. It's just not counted in that number. You know, that kind of brings us to maybe some examples of, I don't know, edibles or medicinals. I mean, again, huge category. But, you know, you mentioned Oregon grape. Now, we have a kind of a cultivated Oregon grape, but it grows all over here, though.
It does. It's kind of little spots here and there all over the homestead in some areas that we really don't want it growing, so we'll probably have to pull it up anyway. But the root is useful for, what is it, a diuretic?
Yes, it's a diuretic. The berries themselves off of Oregon grape.
Yeah, they're great for jam. They're very, I think it tastes a lot like a raw, uncooked cranberry.
Okay.
So it's not,
it's it not does have highly a, palatable.
Yeah, it's very, 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 very tart. And it really does have, like he was saying, that pucker effect where you just go, woo, that just dried out my mouth completely. But it has extremely high levels of pectin. And because of that, it makes it a great addition to jams. You can make it just, you know, Oregon grape berry or Oregon grape jam, but be careful with adding any pectin, additional pectin to that jam, because it will turn into a Jolly Rancher, which Lindy found out earlier. We had a jar-shaped Jolly Rancher at the end of her little experiment. But because of the high pectin, it's great if you want to mix it in with things like raspberry or strawberry, or do a strawberry rhubarb Oregon grape jam, which I think would be a really great combo because that rhubarb's got tartness too, and you could add, you know, the strawberry and enough sugar where you're just bringing out the flavor of the Oregon grape.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's again a good example. But from what we hear, a great jam and jelly, because of it's just deep flavor. And I guess you can add sugar to just about anything and make
jam it yummy. Or jelly. But. Yeah. Well, and the other thing that someone had talked about, which I thought was really interesting, was Oregon grape wine. I hadn't thought about doing something like that. And my beer, I mean, can you flavor beer with anything. Huckleberry beer.
Yeah.
Why can't you do Oregon grape beer?
You could, I'm sure.
Although it's got heavy tannins, maybe not tannins, but it feels like it. So I don't know. Maybe make a good dark red wine or something.
Yeah. But other edibles from the forest. I mean, again, we could go on and on here, but you have almost every part of a plant, at least some plants, can be used. And, you know, a lot of the Native Americans had these skills.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's lost, I think, there's still some of it out there, and people are kind of trying to recapture these skills, but largely lost.
Yeah.
Because everything from the roots, the berries, to the sap, nuts and leaves were very important parts of either diet, just for consumption, for caloric intake, or medicinal value, can be used on many different varieties of trees and plants in the forest.
Yeah, like one of the things he mentioned was moss. And how it has an anticoagulant, and also it's an absorbent material. Antibacterial, if you got a cut or something, you could pull some moss off a tree and press it on there, and it literally will help stop the bleeding, and it will clean up that area and absorb any blood or anything that's coming
out. Yeah, I mean, it was literally their medicinal bandage.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes sense when you think about it. But... Moving on here, so we have, you can have wild raspberries, blackberries, cranberries, blueberries, huckleberries, pine nuts from all our conifers. A lot of times we don't think of pine nuts. And again, a lot of people think, oh, pine nuts, we need to have the Korean pine nut tree or something. That's actually all of our conifers produce pine nuts of some kind.
Yeah.
Some are more easier to use than others.
Well, and he was saying the easiest way he found of getting them, extracting them from the cones, was putting them in a dryer. Now, he has his own dryer for that now because he got sap all over the inside of the dryer and made it unusable for clothing. Women, this is a really good way to get a new dryer. That's all I thought the whole time. I thought, oh, let's gather some pine cones and get some pine nuts out. Darn, we need a new dryer.
That's funny. Not really. So, how about saps and, you know, because when you think of like, okay, when we want to make maple syrup or something like that, we think, oh, the maple tree, you know, the sugar maple, where we get, you know, the pitch and the sap, and then we boil it down and we get syrup.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other things. For example, birch. I knew this. I've heard of it, but I hadn't really studied it all. But birch water. It's apparently an up-and-coming thing, almost like in, you know, the Gatorade has been replaced by these other little coconut water and different things.
Mm-hmm.
But birch water has a sweetness to it and lots of opportunity. Well, in our area, birch is prevalent. It grows really well here, and it's, like I said, there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
So we could tap that. And there's also birch sap, which you can actually make syrup.
Yeah, and you can make xylitol, which is from birch as well. Now, sometimes you can get xylitol. It's made from corn, and that will be a GMO product, and you want to stay away from that xylitol. So anytime you're going to buy xylitol, that's X-Y-L-I-T-O-L, you want to make sure that it's from birch trees.
Yeah.
And not from corn.
Yeah, absolutely. If we move to some of the mushrooms, and again, you have to be very careful here.
Yes.
And we're by no means experts in any of this, but this is one area that we are starting to do some study, and we want to develop at least for personal consumption. Mm-hmm. But this is a huge area of opportunity.
Yeah. Well, and if you can find a place, well, one of the things that he talked about with trying to cultivate mushrooms was studying the environment of the mushrooms, because the mushrooms, each particular type, won't just grow anywhere. You're looking for, like, okay, what trees commonly grow around this type of mushroom, because that mushroom feeds off of
right.
the nutrients from that particular tree.
Right.
What kind of bushes are around?
Right.
What's the environment like? Is it completely covered, or is there some sun that comes in? Is this a partial sun area? So you need to become an investigator of the area of this particular mushroom that you want to cultivate, and then find a good spot on your property or create a spot.
Yeah.
Or you can find it in the wild by looking for these particular types of trees and bushes, and you can find probably your mushroom that you're looking for.
Yeah.
But it's the environment that's important.
Yeah, and that's a great principle to understand. So if you look at the example of the very experienced mushroom picker, that person's not looking for the mushroom on the ground. They're looking for, like you said, the bushes and the trees that mushroom will grow, and that's what gets them to the right area.
Right.
Then they'll look for the mushroom on the ground. And it's the same thing when you're looking at growing anything. You don't try and, like, well, I want to grow this. I mean, in some cases you can do this, but you don't generally say, I want to grow this, and therefore I'm going to then, you know, beat the earth into submission in order to be able to grow that. What you want to start with is, like, what grows well in my area? In this environment, what can I grow easily?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what will thrive in this area? You start there, and then maybe you work to some things that you're going to have to give some TLC to make it grow or whatever. But
yeah,
mushrooms is,
like you said, if you're promoting a good environment, then, you know, and you know what that plant needs to thrive, then you can create that kind of thing around it, either using the plants it requires or maybe substitutes that have the same kind of input, so that you don't have to sit around spraying and weeding and remulching and putting in all these fertilizers
right.
just to get this one plant to grow on your property.
Right, exactly. And that is one of the reasons why we personally are trying to concentrate on perennial systems versus annual systems, although we will still certainly grow annual vegetables. For example, but perennial systems take less work.
Yeah.
They tend to, you know, obviously last longer. You're going to get more value out of them over the time.
Right.
You know, if you can replant cucumbers every year, or you can plant a tree that's going to produce fruit for 60 years. I mean, obviously, you can see the advantages there, but it doesn't mean we won't grow cucumbers.
Right.
Okay. So some mushrooms that are common in the Pacific Northwest, and obviously you would have to research what grows well in your area. Morels, white and yellow chanterelles, oyster mushrooms, rooting cauliflower, hedgehogs, just to name a few. There are tons of different kinds of mushrooms. Many of them are highly toxic.
And a lot of them mimic, those toxic ones will mimic the ones that are non-toxic. So when he was talking about mushrooms, one of the things he kept emphasizing was the spore print to not go, well, it's got the same kind of umbrella, you know, the stem looks the same, blah, 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 and then identify it by that. But actually take a spore print, because each one has its own individual print. And that is really the only way to positively identify something. And even then, he said, if you're not 100% sure, take a little tiny bit, you know, I think he said a teaspoon, and just...
Yeah, I mean, if you look at your basic survival skills when you're trying to eat wild edibles, or determine whether something that you can eat it, I mean, the first thing you do is you rub it a little bit on your skin. See if there's any kind of reaction. If there's not, you put a little bit on your lip. You just rub a little bit on your lip, see if there's a reaction. At any time, if there's a reaction, obviously you stop. If you can get past that, then, you know, you put a little bit on your tongue, etc. And then you may eat a tiny bit, and then you progress, and then you get to the point of, okay, I know I can eat this thing. But mushrooms, you have to be very careful with, extremely careful with. And so...
Because they're the kind of things that, like, they maybe won't react to anything. The only thing they attack is your liver.
Right.
So
it could be very dangerous.
It could be very dangerous. And yeah, he said it could take up to 6 months to die of mushroom poisoning for certain mushrooms, because all they do is slowly attack the liver until it, or the kidneys, and it literally shuts down.
Right.
So he was just saying, you know, take a little tiny bit, eat it. And if you, by the next morning, you haven't had any kind of reaction where your stomach is going, oh, no, 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 you know, vomiting, diarrhea, nausea, whatever, then it's probably safe to eat if you've identified it as, you know, a probable safe mushroom.
Right.
But if you cultivate, it's a whole lot easier, because you know what's growing.
Exactly. And I liked, he made one quick joke, and he said, there are bold mushroom pickers and there are old mushroom pickers, but there are no bold old mushroom pickers.
Right.
Anyway, so if you're not 100% sure, or if you're not, you know, you haven't joined a, you know, mushroom picking society and learned from them, one of the best ways to go is what you just mentioned, is to cultivate your own. So that maybe it's buying spore kits.
Yeah.
And so you know exactly what's growing on these, you know, decaying wood type mushrooms.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Other than that, I would only go with the things that you can absolutely positively identify.
Yeah.
And if you can't, you know, just let it go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's easier to experiment with greens and maybe even, you know, bark and...
Yeah.
And things like that, as opposed to mushrooms.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, even the berries, the bark, the herbs, they're easier to identify. They've got more unique identifying characteristics. Mushrooms, again, tend to mimic each other and look very similar, when there could be one that's toxic and one that's extremely edible.
Right. And as we mentioned before, when you talk about value added, well, mushrooms in the ground, in the forest, have a certain amount of value. When you pick them, it increases that value, because obviously you can use it for personal consumption. And when you decide, hey, I'm going to sell this, that has a certain amount of value. Now, if you sell those mushrooms in bulk to a supplier, you know, that has a certain amount of value. When you decide to direct market that yourself, that has a certain amount of additional value. And if you do something like dry them, that really adds value.
Yes.
And, you know, when you think about, I mean, next time you're in the grocery store, first of all, look at just your regular mushrooms, how much they cost. These little cartons with an ounce or something, you know, cost $5 or $6 or whatever it is. And that's not even a dried mushroom. When you look at what mushrooms cost per pound, it's astronomical. And then when you think about what dried mushrooms cost per pound, it's in the hundreds of dollars a pound.
Yeah. Yeah, the dried mushrooms are really expensive.
Yeah, so we've covered a lot of, you know, again, we didn't go into any detail about medicinals, because that's a huge topic.
Yeah.
That is a huge topic, and maybe we will get there.
Yeah, but someday, some of the things that you can make would be health and beauty products off some of the, you know, wild things you'd have in the forest, you know, whether it be berries and you're mixing that in with something to make a mask, or they're good for coloring things as well. You can use it for like a lip gloss, or, you know, there's those types of things that you could feasibly make fairly easily that wouldn't be medicinal, that you wouldn't have to worry so much about, you know, side effects or making sure that you're not, you know, selling somebody something toxic, that you could still make with using forest edibles.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we'll kind of close out there. We've talked about non-timber forest products and covered some edibles. Of course, those are integrated into that, but it really should be its own subject.
Yeah.
A multi-podcast subject for sure. But mostly some ways that you can either use them for personal consumption or ways to market them. Maybe ways to create a small business.
Yeah. And you know what? Test them on your friends and family. And if they like them, they'll end up talking. They'll talk to people. Then you already have, you know, you're beginning to have a market. Give things away and give them as gifts. Do whatever to try it. If you're looking to market something or looking to see how well does this work for different people, because it works great for me. Just not sure if other people would like it or whatever. Yeah. So use your friends and family as a testing ground.
Absolutely. And if you think about one more thing, if you're someone who likes to buy Christmas presents, for example, to all your friends and family, and you spend a lot of money every season, think about using non-timber forest products to give gifts.
Yeah.
And right there, that'll save you whatever amount of money you normally spend. It might be $1,000.
And you know what? People usually like things like that more. I mean, think about when you go out shopping, talking to women right now, for people for gifts, you're always looking for that handmade, that unique, that something special. And imagine how special and unique it would be to be handmade by you, given specifically to your friends and family as something that, you know, really you invested your time and your heart into.
Absolutely. All right. Our scripture for today is Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine.
That's the podcast for today. Don't forget to visit us at thecourageouslifepodcast.com. Please leave us some comments and questions. Also, like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Thanks for listening. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.